Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
And welcome back to LA Talk Radio. You are listening to LA Talk Radio's very own Writer's Block. I am your Jim Christina, and I'm looking at my wonderful, charming, beautiful, talented, giggly co-host, Bobby Jean Bell, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, hey, Bobby.
Hey, Jim. Great to be with you again this week.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. Hey, I get next week, I get my second COVID, I get my second vaccination. Yay, yay.
Oh, I'm still waiting.
Well, you're going to be able to start scheduling yours Monday.
Oh, well, you know, the state of New Mexico is terrific. I get text messages regularly reminding me that I'm registered and to just be patient. And of course, right. Jim got his, my husband got his very quickly.
Right, right.
And he's been all set now for a couple of weeks, yeah, but I'm waiting.
Well, Jerry and I are going in next Friday to get our second one.
Great.
And then 2 weeks and we can go hug our grandkids.
There you go. Well, you know, I think today is the first anniversary of everything shutting down. Yeah,
I was listening to Biden's speech here before I came in the office, and it's interesting things to say. Well, I'm going to just get into this because this is a guy that, we're getting used to having New York Times bestselling writers on this show, international bestselling writers. I mean, the last three or four, this one is no exception. Steve Barry, he is a New York Times number one internationally bestselling and award-winning author of The Warsaw Protocol, The Malta Exchange, The Bishop's Pawn, The Lost Order, The 14th Colony, The Patriot Thread, The Lincoln Myth, The King's Deception, The Columbus Affair. I'm running out of air. The Emperor's Tomb and Emperor's No Clothes. The Paris Vendetta, The Charlemagne Pursuit, The Venetian Betrayal. His hero, Cotton, is just a terrific guy. And he's the man. Cotton Malone is the man. Ex-State Department, the guy's just like a super spy. He's James Bond with gray hair. What can I say? So, beware, Steve, because the audience is going to go out of control here with their applause. But please welcome back to the Writer's Block for his second hit with our show since August of last year, Mr. Steve Barry. Mr. Steve Barry. I had a brain fart there for just a moment. Welcome back, Steve.
It's good to be here. Your applause sounds like rain.
Well, it pretty much is. You know, you put a microphone out the window, that's what you get. Anyway, the last time you were on with us, I, of course, was in the hospital. You were on with Russ Avison and Richard Polinelli. And I did listen to the show, and it was fun. But we're going to have more fun.
Okay.
Okay, your new book, I have to say, Kaiser's Web is my kind of story. It's got everything in it. I mean, I'm a World War II fanatic, so it's just got like a little bit of everything. But as I was telling Bobby before we went on the air, and I'm going to ask you to give us a brief story synopsis here in a minute, but it's like you take us and you put us in the middle of this maze, and you don't ever let us out. Until the last page of the last chapter, and then I'm not really sure I got out. It's kind of very cool the way you did that, And your characters, even your minor characters, have just great backgrounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're like three-dimensional people. And it's just wonderful to see a writer do that. And if you wouldn't mind, give us a synopsis of The Kaiser's Web, because it's a terrific book. And we're not going to do any spoiler alerts.
No.
Yeah, we're going to try really hard not to.
We're going to try really hard not to.
I'll be very careful with that. A few years ago, I was researching another novel that had nothing to do with World War II, and I was in a used bookshop where I do most of my work, and I stumbled on a book that was on the shelf. I pulled it off, I started reading it, and I learned about something that happened in late 1944, which I never knew happened before, and I didn't know if it was real or not. I checked it out. Sure enough, it was. And then that began the kernel of the seed that was planted that became The Kaiser's Web. I mean, this novel centers around what happened on the night of April 30th, 1945, in the bunker underneath Berlin. And this is not a book about Hitler surviving the war and the Fourth Reich coming and all that. This is nothing. No. It's completely different from that. But it is a book about someone else who was in the bunker that night who disappeared the next day and was never officially seen or heard from ever again, and that's Martin Bormann.
Right.
And Bormann was a fascinating character, and this novel is about two candidates running for the chancellorship of Germany. They both know secrets on the other. The secrets are interrelated. The secrets relate back to 1944, and the revelation of these secrets and the things that happened back in 44 are going to determine the German national election. And my hero, Cott Malone, who's now, this is his 16th novel, gets caught up in this civil war between these two candidates and takes him to South America and to South Africa and to Switzerland and then back into Germany. So it's a globe-trotting adventure with something real from World War II, something I think may shock the reader. I don't want to say what it is because it'll give away what's in the novel. I don't want to do that. But I think you'll go like, wow, I didn't know that, because I was shocked about it too. And you're going to learn a lot about some things that you may not have known. And I've been very much wanting to put Cotton in World War II, but it's been done to death. So I had to find something fresh, and I did stumble onto that. And that's the novel in a nutshell.
Yeah, it's well written to start with. The story is fascinating, and the your references back to Martin Bormann always intrigued me, because I had always thought that he took off, but they finally found him in like Switzerland or England or Italy or someplace.
Well, there have been sightings of him all over the place. I mean, right. There were sightings all over the world. Nothing ever confirmed. They found a body in 73 where supposedly he had been blown up when he escaped the bunker and died. But the DNA testing that they did on in the 90s was in the early stages of DNA testing. Supposedly it confirmed it was Bormann. But they promptly burned the remains and scattered the ashes in the North Sea. So we'll have no way of knowing if any of that's ever true or not.
Right, right. He always kind of reminded me as the Nazis Curly from the Three Stooges. He was extremely criminal.
He was a criminal, yeah. And he was a sociopath, an amoral individual, smart, very clever, very conniving. If he had been in charge of Germany, we could have found ourselves in a lot more trouble, you know, because this guy was much more clever than Hitler, much more ruthless. And by 1943, he was essentially in command of Germany, because you didn't get to Hitler unless you went through Bormann.
Right, right. Well, just luck has it that Hitler didn't listen to anybody. So, no. I mean, and he made some very bad decisions.
No, he's a terrible military leader. Terrible.
Oh, my gosh. Terrible.
Thank goodness for that. But Bormann would have been a different animal to deal with. And thankfully, though, he was not in charge. But he did disappear. He did put in place something that's very interesting. He realized the war was lost by 44, and he put some things into motion, some things that took place after the war, some things that still have relevance today in my German national election.
Now, I understand, and then we'll leave Martin Bormann, but I understand that he put in place some building of compounds and stuff in Argentina and Brazil and Peru, if I'm not mistaken.
all over South America.
Yeah.
He put things into place.
Right.
A lot of Germans immigrated to that area after the war, and it was not by accident. And they
right.
didn't immigrate there to take over the world again. There was other things going on, other things
Absolutely.
That are far more interesting, and things that Cotton Malone gets caught up in.
There you go. There you go. Bobby Jean, I know you're chomping. Well, I can't see you chomping, but I know you want. I know there's a question in your little brain that you want to ask. So have at it.
Well, I just want to say, like Jim said, Steve, this is really such a great mystery with just layers and layers and layers of information and plots and subplots. And like going through a maze, I found myself butting up against the walls. You know, when you're in a maze and you realize you went the wrong way, you definitely write in a lot of red herrings and the story goes this way. And then, oh, no, the story goes that way, which is really like a web. I thought that the in the beginning, you make two comments for pretty quickly in the book that seem to inspire the book, and they're both quotes of Adolf Hitler's, "The masses have little time to think, and how incredible is the willingness of modern man to believe, and then make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe." And this book is full of lies.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And we as the reader go, oh, get it. And then it's like, no.
Well, you know what amazed me is one brain, which would be Steve's brain, came up with all these twists and turns and back and forward, and you have to stop, back up, turn left, turn right, and you never know where you're going to go from page to page. Or, right. or Cotton doesn't even know where he's going from page to right. page. He's just globetrotting at this point. But it's just amazing that some of the situations you put your characters in. And it's just, I don't know where you come up with this. It was phenomenal.
Well, it gets harder and harder as you write books because you don't want to reuse what you've done before. So you
Absolutely.
Have to come up with new and putting your character in jeopardy becomes harder and harder after 20 novels because you come
sure.
up with new stuff. But thankfully in this novel, I did come up with some new stuff, some interesting uh-huh. things. It's a fun scene that opens the novel. And that was fun. Mm-hmm. And there's some other aspects of it as well. And that I get a big kick out of reading the reviews because they all say, well, my God, you wrote that book like 2 weeks ago, obviously, because of the things that you're talking about in the novel are so relevant. But I wrote the book 2 years ago. So,
yeah.
you know, I wrote this book in 2018, 2019, and it turned out to be quite prophetic with some of the things that actually happened subsequently with it. It's just interesting. Mine is told, of course, in the context of the German national elections and,
sure.
and running for chancellor, and they have a different concept over there, and the reader's going to learn how they do run over there, which is very uh-huh. different than the way we do it. But
right.
there's a lot of interesting things in the novel. The biggest challenge in my novels, I try to keep things 90% accurate. I keep it as close to reality as I can. There's 10% I have to trip it up, and that's why there's a writer's note in the back that will tell you where I trip it up and where I don't. But I try to keep it as close to reality as humanly possible.
Uh-huh. Well, you did good. You did good. It's just like some of your reviews here. I'm reading some of your reviews, and they're like the intrigue is intense.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Barry is a master of historical thrillers, arguably the most prolific one out there right now. Yes, even better than Dan Brown. Oh, that's a compliment.
That's high praise. That is high praise.
Barry pumps the veins of history with the action-packed adrenaline of global espionage and intrigue. I love that. So pump my veins there, Steve. You know,
I try.
You did. Well, you did. You done good. You know what? We're going to let's get a little break out of the way first. And then we'll get into that because I really want to know about some of your. Never mind. I can't even think. My brain is sort of stuffed up full of just it's anyway. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block. We will be right back after a brief word from LA Talk Radio.
Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And if you've ever thought that you could be a radio host, well, now is certainly your opportunity. Go to www.latalkradio.com, find the link that says Be a Host, and follow the instructions. You know, everybody's got something to say. And if you've got a show that you think needs to be heard, how about you link up with us? Because we've got 50-minute shows available every day of the week, plus Sundays. So how about giving us a try? That's latalkradio.com. And listen every Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific, for The Writer's Block, right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we are back in the studios now, 6:15, and we're on the air with Steve Barry. And his newest book, The Kaiser's Web, is a novel that if you're a spy guy or love history or love historical fiction, this is a book you got to read. It's just absolutely terrific, and it's just pretty much available everywhere. And if you want to call and talk to Steve, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. And again, get a pencil, as Bobby used to say. The number is 323-203-0815. Specifically, Steve, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your process. And you've got 20 novels with Cotton in there. Do you find – now, we've talked to writers. They say, oh, no. Three novels in a series. That's the only way to go. And see, I've written, 15, 16, 12 with the same characters. So I get you. Is that as long as the characters stay fresh, why not keep writing about them?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no reason in the world why you need to stop after three if you've got more to say and more to do. My case with Cotton is – I explore a new aspect of his personality in each novel, an aspect of his personality I've never explored before. So you're learning something new about Cotton in every novel.
Sure.
And you're learning something there. So, no, I see no reason in the world why you have to stop after three books. There's nothing magical about that unless you just don't have anything more to say.
Well, that's true. Mm-hmm. That's true. Bobby, you have something to say?
Well, and thank you for Cassiopeia. She's a wonderful character. And of course, they're terrific partners together. And I could see that we're probably learning a little something about each one of them with each book. As you say, you're developing those characters and certainly that relationship. There are a couple of strong women in this book, Cassiopeia being one of them. And of course, Marie, the Chancellor, is a really interesting woman. Ada is writing female characters.
Yeah.
And is
that
a challenge for you?
All of my female characters are strong. I really don't have any weak female characters. I'm surrounded by strong women every day. So I deal with them all the time. And so I like it. I enjoy it. I'm used to it. So that's all I really know. So all of my characters are pretty much strong. I'm very careful about that. This novel, as you mentioned, Cassiopeia and Cotton are working together. That's the one thing that I explored about his personality in this novel. I've never actually had them work together as a team, a loving team, not at each other's throats, not problems, not conflict going on. Instead, they're just partners trusting each other, learning to deal with one another and working together and getting the job done. That was the thing I explored here. And it was a lot of fun to have them work as a team, finally, mm-hmm. and save each other's hides on multiple occasions. So I like strong female characters. Cassiopeia is certainly being, definitely one of those, and the other two that you mentioned as well. And I pretty much that's what I'll always write. I don't think I would ever write. I don't really have any weak female characters, and I don't think I ever will.
Huh.
I don't know that there were many weak characters in this book, actually.
Oh.
they're all pretty mission driven and people of action, men and women of action. In the writing of the so many layers to the story, or let me ask this question, like Marie, we learn a lot about Marie because she let us go into her memories, and she thinks back at different times. All the characters do this throughout the book. Suddenly Marie's thinking about her dad, or she's thinking, and it's kind of a way that you let us know about them. You give us their backstories. I, as a reader, found that I often had to reread because there'll be times when a character will be thinking about something, and then the character will say to himself, yeah, this is working. The web is working. And if I wasn't really paying attention, I might miss that hint that you've just, that character has just told me that what I thought was not you know what to think. So even when they're thinking to themselves, they're in action. They're telling us pieces that.
That's your monologue that I try to. I say all the time that when you read one of my books, you actually have to pay a lot of attention.
Yes, you do.
There's no wasted. I don't throw words in there just to throw it in there, and I don't like to put stuff in there. I like everything to have a purpose and a meaning. And if it doesn't have that, it has no business being in there at all. And so, yeah, you have to kind of pay attention in one of my books. There's no question. I use interior monologue quite a bit to exploit the point of view characters and to learn what they're thinking and their motivations. And I don't like a lot of background on characters. I like just enough that I need to in order to tell the story. And that's why how I like to read. And so that's how I like to write them.
Well, and then the characters even get surprised, like the ones that think they're in control.
Who
discover that, you know, well, there's pieces to their history that they don't, you know, that they don't know. We're not gonna spoiler alert, except to say it's a really great cat and mouse game.
Well, there's some surprises. There's three major surprises in this novel, and I set it up that way on purpose. And two of those surprises I did not foreshadow or give any hint in any way that they were ever coming. And I got a big kick out of reading some of the reviews because they all say, well, I saw that coming a mile away. I don't know how you possibly could, because I gave you no hint whatsoever, not even a tiny little clue that was coming. And yeah. I did it on purpose because I wanted to catch you completely off guard.
Yeah. So did you so you knew as the author that these surprises were going to be revealed, or were any of them your characters saying, wait a minute, I want to tell you something about me, Mr. Steve, my author, you know?
Well, I never really adhere to that philosophy. I hear that all the time from writers, that their characters take over and tell them what to do. In reality, that's not really. I mean, you know, we're creating these people. We control everything they say and do. And everything. Now, certainly circumstances, if you set it up, sometimes dictate what a character will end up doing. But I knew what the surprises were going to be when I started, and I plotted the novel to bring it there, and I plotted it to make sure that at least two of those you would have no clue they were coming. Mm-hmm. And because I did want to catch you off guard. And, you know, when you read it, you go, like, wow. Where did that come from? Well, that was the whole point. I wanted it to come out of nowhere, yes.
Yeah.
Don't you find after 20 novels that you've gotten to know Cotton pretty well?
Yeah, I do. I know him very well, and he surprises me every once in a while, but his character is pretty much ingrained, and I have to stay consistent with that. One thing a reader will not tolerate is when you do something completely out of character. Like, it'd be cool, let's just have him do this. Well, no, he would never do that in a million years.
Right.
I can't do that. So I have to stay consistent to him. Now, that doesn't mean he doesn't change and evolve, but you've got to earn that change and evolution. You can't just dictate that it happened.
Sure.
You have to work on it. So, yeah, I know him fairly well, but he does have a few surprises here and there every once in a while. And he's getting a little more introverted and a little more introspective. A little more emotion than I thought he would have, but that comes from my wife, Elizabeth, who interjects and offers changes to it, and she softens him up just a tad.
How do you soften up a tough, hard guy? That's pretty hard.
Well, give him a little feeling here and there, a little thing that I wouldn't give, that I wouldn't necessarily do, but she does. And like this book, the last three words of the book, you know, at the last, I don't want to tell the readers what they are, but I never thought he'd actually say that, but he did.
Yeah. I had I have a character called the Hunter, and he's an old manhunter from Arizona in the 1880s. And you pretty much know what he's going to do from time to time. He's pretty much the same. pretty even tempered. But there's this one novel that I wrote called Still Waters, and he just totally went off character and just shot this Apache, just killed him dead, and turned around and just walked away. And it was just like, holy crap, did he really just do that? Yeah, he did. You know, it's a surprise when my characters do things like that, as I'm sure it is with you.
Yes.
To stay in character.
Yeah, as long as you can, as long as you set it up right and you've earned that surprise,
right?
The reader will say, okay, that's cool. We all do crazy shit every once in a while. Yeah, we all do.
You know? Don't we, you know, though?
You know, but you can't just do it out of left field with no buildup or explanation or anything. Mm-hmm. The reader has to, you know, that crucible has to be there. The fancy word is the crucible. That thing that a character, you know, would never do, but does.
But it does, yeah.
Why? Yeah. And why would he do that? Why does he do this thing that he would never do? There's a reason why. And so as long as the crucible's there, sure, you can do that.
Yeah, how far must he be pushed to go to that route?
Right.
You know, because everybody has a breaking point.
That's exactly right.
And I'll tell you, Steve, that crazy shit is perfectly acceptable. We all do it.
We all do it every once in a while. Yes, we
and,
do.
And usually enjoy it while we're doing it.
Mm-hmm. It's the consequences afterwards.
That's it. How long have you been writing? When did you start?
I was 35 when I wrote my first word, and so I wasted a lot of time. That little voice in my head was going for about 10 years, and I ignored it. But from the day I wrote my first word to the day I sold my first word was 12 years, and I wrote 8 manuscripts during that 12-year period. 5 went to New York publishing houses, rejected 85 times. I made it on the 86th time. 12 years after I started. So it was a long process for me. That was The Amber Room in 2003, and now here we are 20 novels later, 16 Cop Malones, and I'm in 52 countries, 41 languages around the world. You just pinch yourself like, wow.
Yeah. You probably gave up your day job too, huh?
I did. It was a while. I wrote 7. I was a lawyer. I wrote 7 novels still as a lawyer. I quit being practice of law on the 8th novel. So it was a while before I gave up my day job. I had to be certain I could make a living at this, and I was fortunate that I was able to do that.
But see, you're one of the very lucky ones. Most writers, and we get most of them on here, they're not going to be able to make a living out of their writing,
right.
And it's really unfortunate.
It is.
Because we have read some phenomenal books.
We have.
From beginning writers all the way up through New York Times bestsellers. I mean, you know, it's unfortunate that some of these people are just never going to catch a deal with a publisher, one of the big 5, or now 4, I guess. And it's a shame because, you know, they've got their rejection letters, 85 like you do, they still have to work, and, you know, they write for their own pleasure at this point.
It's tough. It's to be a commercial fiction writer today is a very difficult thing to pull off. It was hard when I did it, and it's even harder now. And so, you know, it's just tough, but that's what I wanted to do. And I caught a break one day. All I can say is, you know, just hang in there. I hung in there till one day Lady Luck said, okay, it's been 12 years. I'm going to cut your break today. Today's your day.
That's pretty much what John Sanford said when he was on with us too, that, you know, he got lucky because he got a Pulitzer Prize in the newspaper industry, and he was already well known in publishing. So his first novel, one of the Prey novels, he pretty much rolled right in. He said, but you know, he's making a living out of writing is a tough gig.
Mm-hmm. It is a tough gig, and John and I have talked about that together, and it is. It's a very tough gig, and I'm just lucky that I'm one of the ones who can actually do it for a living and can keep doing it for a living. It was just one of those things that worked out for me.
Yeah, Craig Johnson's one who is very lucky in what he's got going with his Longmire series, and both of those gentlemen, incidentally, were wonderful guests on our show, and so gracious. That's they were just well, and you as you are. I mean, you're so far. You've just been very gracious.
I'm doing good. Okay, I'm doing good.
You're doing great. I mean, doing good. Just take another sip of that beer and relax.
Okay, I'm cool.
Okay, well, you know what? While we're at it, why don't we just go ahead and take another real quick break, and then we'll get into some other aspects of your writing. And you're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina. We'll be right back after a brief word from Out West.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Okay, it is 6:30. We are in the studio. I'm with Bobby Jean Bell. And, of course, our guest on the line is Mr. Steve Barry, the writer of his new novel, The Kaiser's Web, featuring his wonderful character, Cotton Malone. And we're talking about his we're getting into a little bit of his process now. And when do you write? When do you sit down? When you get up in the morning, when do you write and when do you stop writing? Do you have a schedule?
I do. I have a discipline. Writing is a discipline. You have to set up a discipline that works for you. And for me, I'm a morning person. So I get up and I work about 6:30, 7 o'clock, and I work till about 11. Then I take an hour off. I come back. I work till about 2, 2:30, 3 o'clock. By then, my brain's had enough. If I'm having a good day and I'm still got something to say, I keep going. But usually I stop about then. And this is consistent to when I wrote during those 12 years of rejection, because I was a lawyer. I would go to my law office and I would work from 6:30 to 9. And try to do my 1,000 words a day. No one actually ever saw me write any of those 8 novels. I wrote them all alone in my office there. So you find what's your most productive time, and you try to set aside the few hours you need each day to get it done. And I find that, you know, I can do my 1,000 words a day. If I can just keep doing my 1,000 words a day, I can have my novel ready to go in 12 months, and that's what I need to do.
Do you edit yourself as you write?
Absolutely. I write 50 pages, and then I'll edit 50, write 50 more, edit 100, write 50 more, edit 150, do it like that. Uh-huh. By the time I get down to the last 50 pages, I've gone through the previous about 30 or 40 times. And when I get done, I read my novels about 50 times all the way. You know, I do a lot of it. Writing is rewriting. It's all about rewriting and self-editing. This is one thing writers today do not take as seriously as they should, is self-editing. And I was taught that a long time ago. And I'm probably harder on me than anybody would be. Hard as I can be. So you do need to learn to edit. There's no one going to edit your novel and make it this magical, beautiful thing when they're done. That's up to you to do.
That's exactly right. This is just editing, not even self-editing, just editing itself. Every writer should know how to do it.
Yeah, you've got to edit your own stuff, and you've got to be tough on yourself. And then at some point, you've got to get someone to read it who has some knowledge of how to edit, but who can be honest and straight with you. I'm very fortunate that my wife, Elizabeth, is an editor herself, and so I can give she's the first reader of my book when I'm done.
Right.
And she reads it, and she's really hard on it. She really picks it apart and goes through it. And so, you know, you've got to have somebody like that to give you that fresh eye, look at it when the time comes.
Right. Yeah, my wife, Jerry, does the same. She edits she goes through a chapter at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And she beats me up. Okay.
Mine's tough. She's just mean. That's what she is.
Does she go through blue and red pencils like crazy? I have to buy her like 12 every other month.
Mine uses track changes, so she does it. And she just stacks those comments up on the side. She loves to stack them up. Boy, they go like 4 deep on the side. So she's tough.
God bless her.
I have a question, Steve, that's that I don't know that we've ever really asked our guests before. This is the first time that, in order to be sure I had this book read in time for tonight, because it's a little longer than some of what we've had, I both read and listened on Audible. And it was a way that I could keep, when I was walking or driving, or, you know, I could keep in the book, because it was just so much. I really wanted to know how it ended. And so it was very interesting listening to it on Audible. We have these different characters and different accents. And when you write, is any one of the formats for listening, whether it's Audible, there's many different platforms now. As a writer, do you have to think at all about how this will translate to that type of listening for a reader?
No, they will the audio reader will translate it. They will make that happen for you. So I don't really do it. There are books that have been written purely to audio. We did it in the International Thriller Writers years ago with the Chopin manuscript. It was the very first audio book written for audio. So it was geared to audio. It was designed to be listened to. And it won an Audie that year, won an Audible award that year for it. So it has been done that way. In my case, Scott Brick is so good. He takes the manuscript and he knows, he's done all the Cotton books, so he's very familiar with it, and he makes it and brings it alive. He makes it come alive.
Yeah, he was a wonderful narrator. In the beginning, you said that he's done all the books. Were you involved in the selection of him, or was that something your publisher did? How does that come about?
Well, not all writers get to pick their audio people. Most of the time, the publisher does it. But I was in a position where I could choose, and I had a different audio narrator who did The Romanoff Prophecy, The Third Secret, and The Templar Legacy. And then when we got to the Alexandria Link, I had a little more clout then, and I asked if Scott could take over, and he's done everything since then. So he's done about 15 Cotton Malones. And mm-hmm. So then he went back and did The Amber Room as well. So he's done all of my books but three. So at some point, some writers get that ability to pick, and I was one of those.
Well, it's very engaging, both the written word and Audible. I just throw that out to our listeners that, it was very easy to go kind of from the page to the ear, very simple as a reader to stay in tune with what was happening. Yeah, yeah.
He does a good job. He's the number one audio narrator in the world.
Ah. Well,
your dialogue, though, is crisp and it's clean, yet it's so natural sounding when you read it. You've got the pauses in there where they need to be. You've got everything's in there that people do when they speak naturally. And I always find that amazing that people that can write dialogue as well as that. I pat you on the shoulder if you were sitting here.
Well, thank you. But, thank you. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Go ahead.
I was taught a lot about with dialogue. I learned is that, you know, dialogue is not filler. You know, when my characters speak, they need to speak.
Right.
And they have to say something. And so I was taught to, you know, be very careful with your dialogue and how you do those things. And I try to keep it short and sweet. I don't like wasted words, and I don't like a lot of filler and things like that. I like to keep it tight and moving along as fast as I can.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I do pretty much the same thing. So, of course, I'm not a New York Times bestselling writer either. So, you know,
not yet.
I'm an Amazon top 1,000. I am actually that. So, what you got anything else there, Bobby?
Do you want to ask the question?
Well, we can ask it now, or I can wait a few minutes. But I'll go ahead and ask it now. The name of the show, of course, is The Writer's Block, Steve. And have you ever had writer's block? And if you have, how did you get out of it?
See, I don't think that really exists, to be honest with you, and I'll explain what I mean by that. Every writer has a little voice in their head. That's why they write. They have a little voice in their head that tells them to write. It doesn't tell them to write a bestseller and sell a bunch of books and all that. The voice says, I need you to sit down and write. Please, just sit down and write. If you'll sit down and write, I'll shut up. If you don't, I'm going to nag you to death. And it's the little voice that keeps us going. It's the little voice that drives us to keep moving. It's the little voice that kept me going for 12 years during the rejection process. There's nothing fun about being rejected 85 times. So if writer's block means you get stuck, well, that happens every day. That happens to me 3, 4, 5 times every day to get stuck. And that's not that's not a writer's block. That's just the natural process that you get stuck. Right. How do you fix it? You figure out a way to do it. For me, I go do something else. I clean my head out, or I go do a chore, or I go do this, something, and it goes away, and you get back to work. To me, true writer's block is when the little voice in your head goes silent.
Right.
And when it goes silent, you're done.
Right.
You're finished. You're done. And I know writers whose the little voice has gone silent in them, and it's gone, and they don't have the desire any longer to sit down and to write. So I look at writer's block a little different than others, not just getting stuck, but the little voice going away. And that's the scary part.
We had a writer on not too long ago that we asked a question, and I don't remember who it was, Bobby, maybe you do, but they said, or he or she said, I've had writer's block for the last 5 years.
I
don't remember who it was.
I don't either, but yeah.
He may be saying the little voice in his head is not telling him to drive
forward.
Well,
I think that's
anymore.
What he meant, yeah.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
See, here we call it writer's pause.
Yeah, I mean, you call it, yeah, well, you know, to me, writer's block, it means to get stuck. That's normal. You're going to get stuck all the time.
Sure.
That's not, there's no way in the world you just sit down as magical stuff just flows out of your brain with no interruption and no anything. That's just not possible. It doesn't happen. But, you know, the writer's block to me is when you're done, when your voice says, I don't want to do this anymore. And you don't have to sit down and write every day. I'm not going to nag you anymore. And I know writers that's happened to, and they're basically finished. They're over.
Let me ask you, because I there are some people that when you sit down to write a novel, do you go to chapter 1 through chapter 35 in sequence, or do you, does something come pop into your head and you go and you type it separately, and then when it comes to the point where you need to insert it, you just put it in?
Well, I mean, if something comes to my head, I'll put it in my notes that I'll, you know, so when I get there, but I write the novel in sequence because, as you've already said several times, there are a lot of twisted turns in the novel.
Oh, yes.
And I can't skip around there because I have to keep those in sequence, and I have to be very conscious of those. So I write the novel in precise order, one chapter after another,
Okay. We're going to take our break, and then we'll be back, and so don't go away. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is LA Talk Radio's very own Writer's Block, and we'll be back right after this brief word from Creative Edge.
Hi, Jim Christina here for Creative Edge Publicity. And you know there's a reason that authors flock to Creative Edge? Yes, it's true, and no one would believe it, but it is true. Creative Edge, the grassroots publicity firm that has stayed community-minded, is growing. And not only growing, but busting right out of their seams. With a client base of over 70 authors, 2 New York Times bestsellers, 6 USA Today bestsellers, and multiple international bestsellers and award winners, Creative Edge in 4 years has become one of the mainstays in the publicity book market, offering reader-focused opportunities in all levels of media, including podcasts, radio, TV, print, and much more. When it comes to publicity, Mickey Mickelson and Creative Edge are experts in the book industry. Look him up at www.creative-edge.services. Creative Edge, it's your brand, your future.
And my publicist, incidentally. So we have we've got a few minutes left, so let's just get right down into it. Okay, Bobby Z, go ahead.
Steve, for our writers, maybe newer writers that are out there, do you have some great advice on how to keep your imagination alive and growing? And what do you do to keep yours active?
Well, mine mainly comes from traveling. I like to go to new places. I like to see new places and see things. And of course, for the last 20 and 21, we're not doing any traveling whatsoever, so haven't happened. Thankfully, I'd done most of that research and things prior to all that happening. But travel does it mainly for me. Going to new places and new things and seeing things. There's just so much you see on the ground that you wouldn't see in a book or whatever. But it's not to say that reading doesn't do it. As I said, so the Kaiser's Web, I stumbled onto something reading in a book. So you just have to be inquisitive. I say all the time, when you're looking for a new idea or something like that, you go looking for it, you will never find it. It has to find you. So you have to get yourself in a position where it can find you. And for me, traveling is that, where I'm somewhere. And I can't tell you, of my 20 novels, probably well over half, the ideas came from being on the ground in some place and somebody says something that captures my attention with something I didn't know that eventually becomes a novel.
I'm going to take a wild flying guess here and guess that musty old bookshops are one of your favorite places to be.
Oh, gosh, yes. I love used bookshops. There's so much treasures in there. The one I go to is in Jacksonville, Florida. It's called the Chamblin Book Mime, and it's huge. He must have 10,000 volumes just in the history section. It's just humongous, and it changes every day. There's people bringing boxes and boxes of books in this place, and I've been going there for 30 years. I live 3 hours from it now, and I still go to it.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, that's how far away I live from it now, but I still go there. And that's where I do all my research, because I use around 300 to 400 sources to write a novel, and 90% of those are physical books, and most are bought at the Chamblin Book Mine, and there's he has so much there. So, yes, there's a lot of treasures to be found in an old bookshop.
And I totally agree with you. I love just walking in the door because the smell. The smells are just, books have a particular odor.
They do.
Of fragrance, as it were. Yeah. And it's just, it's compelling. It draws you in like an old friend, I guess.
That's exactly right. A Chamblin Book Mine, it definitely has that smell when you come in the door of thousands and thousands and thousands of volumes that have been in there. And it's just, it's so much you can learn. So many things you stumble on.
Yes.
So much cool stuff in there.
Yeah, it's like the internet. You just go one book to another, and you find yourself with a stack in front of you,
wondering
how you spent 7 hours there.
I do it. I used to do it every 4 or 5 weeks. Now I do it about once every 2 or 3 months, and I go out of there with boxes of books, and when I'm done with the novel, I bring them back and trade them in and get my credit and start over again.
I was going to ask that question. Okay. Well, I thought it was kind of fun that Cotton has a used bookstore, and I figured that you had to, you also had to have a great love for the older books.
Yeah, that's where the cool, there's so much cool. I have shelves here in my office of probably 200 travel guides from the late 19th century, early 20th century, of Europe, because, nothing changes over there. So those travel guides will tell me locations and colors and materials and all kinds of information. And I keep those here and I use them constantly. So, I'm a firm believer in books. I mean, unfortunately, ebooks, I do some ebooks, very few, because I need an index, and the index of ebooks are useless. So, when I use an ebook, I got to go through every page. And I don't read 300 to 400 books, but I read large chunks of 300 to 400 books, and an index helps me narrow down what I need to read.
Yeah, I find Wikipedia is a good place to start because they've got great bibliographies there. And
it's an idea.
You start
get you started there. Then you go find the books to back it up.
Exactly. Well, what's on the horizon for Steve Berry?
Well, next year, Cotton's going to take a year off, and I'm going to write a standalone with a brand new character that I've been wanting to create for a long time. He's from the United Nations, and he's the same kind of story, action, history, secrets, conspiracies. It's a great book. It's going to deal with the most stolen and vandalized piece of art in history. And I'm going to let you – I'm going to let everybody figure that out. They can Google it to figure out what is the most stolen and vandalized piece of art in history. So he'll be there. Then Cotton's coming back in 23 and 24. He'll be back then.
Okay. What's on your nightstand that you're reading now?
Books about Romania, because I'm going to do a book about that in 2 years. And so I'm starting to do the preliminary research. So I'm learning all about Romania. I was supposed to go there in May of last year, but I'll go next year, I think, over there.
Yeah.
I'm learning about that country. It's a fascinating place, and I want to get cotton there.
It is. Actually, I have a daughter-in-law from Romania, and she's from Transylvania, actually.
I'm going to set the novel in that area, yeah.
Yeah, she's quite the young lady. So, yes, Romania is extremely interesting.
Very interesting.
So you're going to you got a standalone coming. You got another cotton novel coming in a couple of years. Wow, you're a busy guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm okay for the next 3 years. I got a job for the next 3 years.
There you go. There you go. Well, look, Steve, it's been great having you, but we're out of time. So we're going to have to say goodnight, but thank you so much for joining us. I know it's kind of late there in Florida, but hey, we is what we is.
It is. No problem. I've enjoyed being here.
Well, thank you. We've enjoyed having you. And if you wouldn't mind, tell our audience where they can find you online and where they can find your books.
Find the books in all the stores in all formats, hardcover, audio, large print, ebook, whatever. They're everywhere right now. The Kaiser's Web's out there right now for all over. But if you want to learn about the Kaiser's Web and all of my novels, you can go to steveberry.org. Everything is there.
Okay. And once again, Steve, thank you for joining us. It's always a pleasure when we have another New York Times bestselling author grace our airwaves. So we do appreciate it.
Thank you. And hopefully I'll see you next
year. Just so you know, you just went out to about 250,000 people. So and a bunch of new writers. So you got somebody excited someplace.
Good. That's the whole point. People did it for me years ago.
There it is. So again, thank you so much, Steve.
All right. Thank you, sir. Night.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. And next week is Russ Havison night. And our guest will be a young lady, Lily McKenzie. And she's got this supernatural thing going. And it's going to be an interesting read. It's a shorter book. It's got a lot of stuff in it. That's magic wands and unicorns. Kind of stuff you really like. But Russ will be with us next week, and then, of course, Bobby Jean will be back with us week after. And we have we have such a great lineup of guests coming this year. Tuscany, our imprint, Tuscany Bay, we just finished a series of children's books for Mary Elizabeth Jackson, the Poolicious books. They're now out and for sale on Amazon. And my book, Jefferson's Chance, just got hardbound. So it is now available live. It can get it all online bookstores and Amazon, or you can get it from my website. It's exciting. It's exciting. And you still need to write a book, buddy.
Well, and I want to say just a quick congratulations to all the Western Writers of America winners, the Spur Award winners. I think I put a link up to that announcement on the Writers Block Facebook page.
You did.
Johnny Boggs was
Johnny
a winner.
Boggs. Yes. Yeah.
And Jim Jones with Randy Houston won for Song of the Year. And we know some of the finalists, J.R. Sanders and another song finalist, Doug Figgs and Floyd Beard and Mariam Funk. And it was so, you know, it's really fun when you read lists like that, Jim, and you go like, oh, I know that person, or oh, that person's been on the show.
I know, isn't that? I think this is Johnny's
so
like sixth or seventh Spur Award. So he's
ninth.
Is it ninth?
I think it said it was
so
his ninth.
He's prolific, and he's been on the show a few times, and he's a good friend of ours, a personal friend. And I just love Johnny. In fact, I just pick up the phone every now and then, just give him a holler to see if he's still breathing.
Yeah. So it's really fun to see those announcements. Yeah.
Yep. So, well, that's us for us tonight. And Bobby Jean, as I said, we'll be back a week from 2 weeks from tonight.
Right, 2 weeks from tonight.
And Russ will be here next week with me. And for Bobby Jean Bell, of course, Jim Bell, myself, Jim Christina, and the bookie, Ronan Rosner, and Sam Hassan, the owner, the wonderful man that makes all this possible, and LA Talk Radio. We, of course, are out of here.